They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Whether you're in the car for the holiday weekend or making guesses about this economy, the question is the same. Are we there yet? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, July 1st. Good to have you along. Wall Street's favorite guessing game these days seems to be, are we there yet, when it comes to a recession? Now, baked into that assumption is this idea that given high rates of inflation and the tightening monetary policy in response, that we are headed to a recession. To help us assess whether that's really the case, I'm joined by a couple of our Friday regulars, Brian Chung of Yahoo Finance and Lynette Lopez of Business Insider. Hey, you two.
Happy Friday.
How's it going?
Hey, Lynette, I'm going to start with you because you just wrote about this, about how Wall Street's elites are sensing an inevitable recession. Why is that?
The biggest fear on Wall Street right now is that the rising prices have set up a psychological dynamic in the United States right now, where wages start going up to meet prices, and then prices go up because wages are going up, and there's no stability in terms of what you know you're going to pay for something tomorrow or what you want to be paid tomorrow. And that's a really difficult way to manage an economy. In fact, it's near impossible. So what the Federal Reserve is trying to do is chill the economy out so that dynamic doesn't happen. Wall Street thinks it may have already started. We don't have the evidence for that yet. But, you know, that's just the worst thing that could happen, basically.
Brian, what's the other side of it? If you have all these doom and gloom predictions, is there anything out there making us think that this landing may be a little bit softer than that?
Well, if there is one indicator, it's that the consumer household balance sheet and businesses themselves appear to be pretty good, and they're not showing signs of wear and tear quite yet in terms of what you might normally see in a pre-recessionary dynamic, where you see savings, for example, going down, or you see companies tapping into cash reserves that they have to really buckle down here. That's not necessarily happening right now. And one argument might be, well, that's because of the lush stimulus cash that we had gotten pumped into the system by both the Biden stimulus bills, as well as the first round of the CARES Act from the Trump administration, alongside the unprecedented amount of money printing from the Federal Reserve. Now, the other side of that coin is that's also the reason why we've had high inflation. It's because of that stimulus on the fiscal and monetary side of things that people and businesses have been able to consume things and make investments that have really fueled a lot of the price increases. So that's something where the Federal Reserve has to decide, well, we either address that by lowering inflation by dramatically raising borrowing costs through interest rates, but that also risks tilting the economy into a recession by pumping the brakes a little bit too hard on the recovery.
I do want to get into the inflation numbers that we got this week in a second. But Brian, staying with you for a second, when it comes to sort of companies preparing for this, yes, you have sort of these big banks saying we're worried about a recession, but you're also seeing retailers starting to give indications that they're buckling down as well.
Yeah, and you're starting to see the demand side of the equation maybe show signs of cracking, because that's really been the story for, let's say, the last 12 to 18 months has been a robust consumer going out and buying things as a kind of way to reengage with the post-pandemic economy. Some people have described that as revenge spending. But at the same time, you have started to see retailers like Target and Walmart, this was very much a big story a few weeks ago, perhaps over-ordering during the last year or so, ordering too many patio sets, ordering too many large appliances that ended up crowding out a lot of space in their warehouses that they could have otherwise used for toiletries and other household items that actually would have been a better use, which is a reason why maybe you're going to start to see some discounting. So again, the demand side of the equation, not necessarily wholesale. This isn't the case for, let's say, for example, clothing retailers, but in some sectors of the economy, you're starting to see that.
And Lynette, there are several reports out saying that the supply chains are just now starting to ease up. What does that mean for, as consumers are kind of pulling back a little bit on spending, are we just going to have a glut of stuff?
Well, what that means for inflation is that we're hoping that the supply chain easing brings down inflation naturally so that the Fed won't have to be as aggressive about raising rates. So we're hoping that that just, you know, flips. But will we have a glut of stuff? Probably not. Ideally, that would be great. That's what kind of the retailers are starting to show us, that they over-ordered and now they're starting to get backups of stuff. But that just means sales and hopefully prices are coming down. But the last thing I'm worried about is too much stuff right now.
But we are worried about inflation. And Lynette, you know, we've got these two different numbers. So inflation is level, yet still pretty steep, at least according to the PCE index. What do you think the numbers that we have now are indicating in terms of where the Fed may go with its next rate hike?
The Fed, the numbers we're seeing now means the Fed will keep going. This is just 8%. That's all just too high. And hopefully, we've reached a peak, but this peak, if it is that, it's still aggressive. And let's hope that supply chains loosening up, that will contribute measurably, but we just don't know yet.
Brian, next week we get jobs numbers. What are you predicting there?
Well, I don't know if my
pull out the crystal ball
matters, but I'll do my best. I mean, when we talk about just kind of what the street would like to see, you would like to see a headline number that continues to show a good pace of job gains in the month of June. Obviously, we need to also take a look at the unemployment rate because that's what the Federal Reserve is watching. We know that we're at 3.6% as of the last read in May. By the way, 3.5% was where we were at before the pandemic began, and that was also a 50-year low. So the Federal Reserve is already encouraged by what we're seeing. Now, on the other side of the coin, you actually might not put that much water into the overall headline number if you're thinking about a policy response here. It's really going to be about wage growth, and that kind of is part of the inflationary story, right? We want to see people getting paid more, but the pace of wage growth that we have seen in this recovery has been at a rate that some economists would say is perhaps above the capacity of the economy and is a reason why we're seeing inflation rates at levels that we have not seen before. So that wage price spiral fears where higher wages require those companies to pack that into what they're selling to the consumer, that's very much a big story, which is why that's going to be in focus when we get that jobs report a week from now.
Brian Chung of Yahoo Finance and Lynette Lopez of Business Insider, thanks, you too.
Thanks.
Thanks.
On Wall Street Today, an okay end to a rough patch. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The retail chain Kohl's, which sells everything from American flag t-shirts to that patio furniture we were just talking about, said this morning the company itself is no longer for sale. It was in negotiations to sell itself to the Franchise Group, owner of brands including the Vitamin Shoppe, but it's ending those talks. One of the reasons Kohl's gave for the change of heart is a difficult retail environment. And Kohl's isn't the only big retailer facing challenges, Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports.
Retailers have lots of practical reasons to worry customers will stay away. Inflation, rising interest rates, the wrong kind of inventory, and continuing supply chain problems. Sucharita Kodali is a retail analyst at Forrester.
You basically have this environment that could spell, you know, catastrophe for retailers.
Which means retailers have to figure out how to get through the current economic moment and maybe ask themselves some kind of existential questions, like, where do we fit in? Brian Kilcourse is a managing partner at RSR Research.
Why do you exist is a really good question. And I think Kohl's probably is struggling with that. Why do they exist?
One reason to exist, Kilcourse says, is to provide a place to gather. There's a particular hunger right now among consumers to get out. And if big box stores can provide a feeling of community, that could help bring people in.
Stores are a social place. It's where we meet. People like to shop. It's an old human behavior.
To make sure there's inventory there for those humans to buy, some retailers are investing in AI-powered software to forecast demand. Laura Kennedy is an analyst at CB Insights.
There's solutions that use cameras to computer vision to watch what's on the shelf, see if it's in stock, tell another system that it's not in stock, and then that other system can order.
Kennedy says retailers are also investing in technology that makes it easier to change prices, which is another way to keep up with the times. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
As we've reported, a growing number of companies have announced a new employee benefit following the Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade. These companies say they'll cover expenses for travel out of state for abortion care. That's for employees living in states with restrictions. But how exactly is that going to work? Marketplace's workplace culture reporter Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
The Human Resource Department at Lattice, a performance management platform, has been working around the clock to figure this out, says Chief People Officer Kara Brennan-Alamano.
This is yet another thing on the plate of HR folks who have had to help navigate through a pandemic. And in this particular situation, things are changing daily, and it's not easy stuff.
Most important, she says, is addressing privacy concerns. A worker shouldn't have to ask their manager or offer any personal information directly to the company to use the benefit. Alamano says organizations could offer it through a health insurance plan, but coverage can vary, and that would require filing for reimbursement.
We want it to be a situation where people have the cash in hand because timing is such an important issue.
So Lattice plans to offer a medical travel stipend available for any healthcare need through a supplemental third-party provider. These providers often cover services like fertility treatment or gender-affirming care, and they sometimes act as advocates to connect workers with health resources. Owen Tripp is the co-founder and CEO of Included Health, which works with more than 250 employer clients in this way.
They can rely on us to deliver, you know, highly trusted, clinical, safe, and ultimately private service.
He says employers foot the bill, but that's about it.
While they can see the total numbers of people utilizing services within a population, they do not see the details, the names, the demographics of those people.
Generally, such programs are available only to full-time regular employees. Match Group, the dating app company based in Texas, has been providing travel benefits even for part-time or contract workers who don't qualify for their health insurance. It's through a partnership with Planned Parenthood Los Angeles, says Chief Communications Officer Justine Sacco.
We have a dedicated toll-free number. They could call that number. Planned Parenthood would verify their employment status, and then they would book their travel, their hotel, whatever medical procedures were necessary.
Setting up a secure system to offer benefits is one thing, but actually making employees feel comfortable using them is another, says Brian Kropp, chief of HR research at Gartner.
One of the things that we'd really recommend companies doing is working with ethics professors at a local college or university to have them put a stamp of approval on what you're doing.
He says companies also need to foster a culture, starting with management, where it's clear that it's okay to take time off without giving a reason.
That creates a moment where those employees either have to lie to their manager or share this private moment.
And the less employers know about how employees use such benefits, the better, says employment attorney Krista Mitzel, because accessing these services, even out of state, could be a crime in some places.
The more neutral and mainstream the policies are, where they could be argued, that this stipend covered any procedure. It wasn't meant to be abortion. It wasn't meant to be XYZ. Those will be defenses that the company will, you know, set forth about why they did or did not violate the law.
Unless a company actively wants to challenge such laws, as Mitzel expects some to do. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up,
and I'm able to live in a nicer neighborhood.
Well, that's nice. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 321 points, 1%, to finish at 31,097. The NASDAQ was up 99 points, 0.9%, to end at 11,127. And the S&P 500 added 39 points, 1%, to land at 3825. For the rest of the week, though, all three indicators were down. For the week, the Dow lost 1.2%, the NASDAQ shed 4.1%, and the S&P fell 2.2%. Stephanie Hughes just talked about retail woes. Kohl's unzipped nearly 20%, Macy's dressed down 1.9%, Target, though, buttoned up 0.8%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.88%. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. One of the several significant Supreme Court rulings this week was the EPA ruling we talked about yesterday, which put severe limitations on the agency's power to curb carbon emissions from power plants. But states are also involved in the emissions debate. In upstate New York, for example, a power plant on Seneca Lake has become a focal point of the debate over crypto mining. And now state officials have decided not to renew an air permit for that plant, Greenwich Generation. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
New York has among the most ambitious carbon reduction goals in the country. The state's Department of Environmental Conservation cited those goals in its decision about the Greenwich plant, which came after steep local opposition from activists like Yvonne Taylor of the group Seneca Lake Guardian.
These cryptocurrency miners are spreading like a cancer across the United States.
In a statement, Greenwich Generation said it made a substantial offer to reduce its emissions and said it plans to appeal the decision that's being watched across the crypto mining industry. And it is an industry, says Colin Reed, a professor at the State University of New York at Plattsburgh.
These are highly corporatized and well-funded companies that are now in mining. They're not the little backyard mines we saw perhaps 4 or 5 years ago.
As the price of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies plummets in New York, the industry is also fighting a 2-year statewide moratorium on repurposing fossil fuel burning plants like Greenwich for crypto mining. John Olson of the Blockchain Association, a crypto industry group, says the decision on Greenwich makes sense. That might come as a surprise, but he says it means a broader moratorium isn't necessary.
We have demonstrable proof that these kinds of issues and concerns on the environmental and energy level can be handled administratively.
Activists, though, say they don't want to see this continue to be a town-by-town fight. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Crypto crypto mining is basically a process of running algorithms. And algorithms are pulling in all sorts of data and spitting out results that shape many of our daily interactions, including the kind of financial lives we lead. Take, for example, the algorithm that determines your credit score, perhaps made famous in that run of TV ads featuring hipster musicians with bad credit. I was getting depressed because of all the stress I was feeling at home. Had a poor credit score and the number would haunt me wherever I go. The idea was to get consumers to regularly check their credit score, for a fee, of course. Your credit score is a number from the 300s to the mid-800s, and you probably have several of them. Lenders use these scores to determine how risky it is to give you a loan or offer you some other kind of financial product. And these scores are the output of algorithms, which pull data from credit reporting agencies like Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion about how you manage debt. When your debt goes up, your score goes down. When you pay a little off, it goes the other way around. But the algorithm isn't quite that simple and may not rely just on how good you are with money. For example, your score can help determine where you live.
It got me a better rate when I bought my house, so it cost me less money to live.
Laura Erickson is a retired academic advisor in Edina, Minnesota, just outside Minneapolis. She bought her house in 1998 and refinanced in 2002.
And I'm able to live in a nicer neighborhood than I would if I'd had a higher interest rate and had to spend less money on a house.
Even though she's pretty settled and comfortable in her life, no plans for any big purchases coming up, Erickson says she stays on top of her numbers, securely in the 780s, because they affect other parts of her life as well.
I just watch my credit scores because it affects my rate on my insurance. Car and auto insurance, you get the best rate if you have a good score.
And to get a good score, say the upper 700s or higher, you need a good history with those credit reporting agencies, which track your credit cards and loans, and most importantly, whether you pay your bills on time. And all that data goes into the algorithm.
A highly predictive algorithm. It's one we develop from millions of anonymized credit reports.
Ethan Dornhelm is a vice president in the Scores and Predictive Analytics Unit at FICO, the company behind the main credit scoring model used by most lenders.
And we take this algorithm and deploy it at the credit bureaus, and that is actually where your FICO score is calculated.
Dornhelm says even though the idea of an algorithm may sound complex, the folks at FICO try to keep it simple.
If I had a consumer's credit report in front of me, I could actually calculate their FICO score by hand within 10 minutes or so.
The algorithm looks at historical information about a person's credit and spending habits, says Manchu Puri, a finance professor at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University.
That will be information such as what are the past loans that you took out, you know, the credit cards, your lines, were you late, did you default? You know, all this information is taken in and packaged into a credit bureau score.
In addition to FICO scores, there are other credit scoring models, such as the Vantage Score, plus individual banks and lenders often have their own teams of data scientists, all pulling from the data credit bureaus have about you, but using their own algorithms to create their own scores.
The whole access to formal credit markets, that has typically relied on having a credit bureau score, right? And so people who have thin credit histories or thin credit files, they have trouble, right, getting a mortgage or other things because you don't have a score.
And that can create or exacerbate economic inequality, sometimes blocking people from accessing financial tools to build wealth. Plus, some question if our financial lives should be so tied to a backwards-looking algorithm.
Whether or not you paid a bill on time 5 years ago may not be that predictive in whether or not you're going to pay back a loan going forward.
Aaron Klein is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Most people who fail to pay back a loan do so because of an exigent circumstance, like a medical catastrophe, a death in the family, a divorce, or a job loss. These things are not necessarily well modeled by whether or not you were late on a bill in the past.
Plus, Klein is concerned about credit scores and algorithms designed around your ability to pay back a debt creeping into other parts of our lives.
Look, my car insurance rate was lowered despite a less than stellar driving record because I had good credit.
Just like retired homeowner Laura Erickson in Minnesota, who, while she's proud of her score, says she feels weird when it comes with a value judgment.
When I went to do a refinance on my house several years ago, and the mortgage broker complimented me on my high score. And I was like, okay, you know, you don't know what to do with it. It's like, okay, I guess I'll get a good rate.
But the credit scoring system doesn't always work out so well for folks. Over on our podcast, Marketplace Tech, we're doing a whole series on credit scores and the algorithms behind them. You can check it out on our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, let's talk about 4th of July celebrations. Communities all over the country are canceling or delaying fireworks shows. In some cases, because problems in supply chains mean the fireworks are still en route, and in other cases, because there aren't enough technicians. The American Pyrotechnics Association points to inflation in the prices of materials to make fireworks, shipping costs, and insurance costs as additional reasons why it's difficult and expensive to put on a show this year. Here's your moment of economic context. New research out from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York found that how much you're feeling rising prices in this economy may depend on your race. Since March of last year, inflation for Black and Hispanic Americans has gotten worse than for White and Asian Americans, about 2 to 6/10% higher. This is likely due to what different groups might be more likely to spend money on, like rising rents versus stable mortgages. And the researchers suggest those disparities are probably even larger than they measured. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.